Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks. Thanks so much for that, Michael. Just to start off the questions. I don't know if you know, but there's a book called Characters of Fitzrovia, and you're mentioned in it. So you are officially a character of Fitzrovia.
Why?
Well, because you studied at Middlesex Hospital.
For a week. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So I just wanted to, I suppose, ask about that part of your biography and the sort of studying medicine. And
yes.
To what degree that affects your poetry and what, to the degree to which you draw on that in your poetry?
Yeah. When I was 16, two things had happened, or several things had happened to me. One was that I'd gone to see Beyond the Fringe, which was Jonathan Miller and Alan Bennett and the rest of it. That was one thing. And the other thing I'd done is biology O-level. And I'd somehow thought that I quite liked biology O-level, and I didn't understand quite why I was dropping it, because I was about to go off and do English, History and French at A-level, you see. And I just happened to let this drop at a conversation at the tea table, and I said, isn't it funny that I sort of not doing biology, I like biology, and for some reason that I wasn't able to figure out immediately, but it became apparent later, my parents leapt on this and said, you like biology? Ah, you know what you could do? You could become a doctor. Far be it for me to think that they're Jewish stereotypes, my parents, but anyway, my son, the doctor, and all that. So suddenly, I sort of got onto this kind of, what is it? It's almost like a treadmill. I said, carry on doing arts A-levels, and you could then go to a medical hospital and do what used to be called First MB, and I was rushed around to see their mate, Chick, believe it or not, that was his nickname. I think his name had been Chizinski, Jewish doctor. And suddenly I was drawn into the Middlesex Hospital, and I was cutting up rabbits and rats and things like that, and looking through something called a spectroscope, I think, and having not the bloody idea what it was I was doing. And so I got cold feet, but you couldn't get out of courses very easily in those days. I know it seems a bit strange to those of you who are quite young. So I had to think of a ruse as to how to get out of it. And also I had to convince my parents. So I had this huge obstacle to try and get out of it. Well, the first ruse was that my brother, a very clever chap, had got himself into Oxford. So I thought, well, apparently at Oxford at that time, as opposed to here in London, you could swap courses. So ruse one, get yourself to Oxford. So I breezed up to Oxford, pretended I was mad keen on medicine, that the one thing I really wanted to do in life was chop people up and be a surgeon or something, and they believed that. But then I had the real job trying to convince my dad, and that was very, very difficult, and that took about a year. So very subtle propaganda. I've completely failed until I figured out the way. I was going out with the daughter of his boss. Clever, huh? And she spoke to the boss, and the boss talked to my dad, and overnight it worked. I say boss, I say in an academic sense, it was just next door at the Institute of Education, but anyway, the head of my dad's department. So that was what I did. Has it influenced my writing? Well, I did do a book of science poems for kids called Centrally Heated Knickers. And quite genuinely, yes, I can honestly say that it has. Right, how can I put it? I think human beings investigate the world. We can't stop ourselves doing it, and we just have lots of different ways of doing it. And scientists have invented this empirical method thing, which mostly gets abused in education, which is a great shame, because they just ask questions that teachers know the answers to, which is the complete opposite of what empiricism is. And poetry and fiction is also a way of investigating the world, and I love the fact that that's what it can do. And I sometimes think that poets are scientists in the true sense. They are human scientists investigating the world using language, and so that is actually what I think I'm doing. I'm being a scientist. I'm observing and writing and trying to discover. You know, science is investigation and discovery, and I think that's what I'm doing.
Great. Any questions from the audience? At the back.
Yeah, I wasn't familiar with your work as a scene. I thought the way you read it, it's a sort of performance element. accept the anecdote, so there's some sort of stand-up element. Is that influence in your writing, or has there been any stand-up influence in your writing?
Yeah, no, that's a very fair question. When I first started writing poetry of any kind, I thought what I was doing a kind of imitation come rehash of the first pages of Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. I was trying to write in the voice of a child. Why was I doing that? I don't know. I haven't got to that point yet. But anyway, I was trying to recreate my childhood, but in the voice of a child. But I thought this was an adult thing to do. Yes? And I wrote the whole set of these poems, and then I tried hawking them round various publishers and failed miserably until someone pointed out, why don't you take them to a publisher of children's books? So I took them, and then that got turned down several times until eventually one person thought, yes, very good, we like this. And so they married me up with Quentin Blake, and my first book came out in about 1974. So there was this book of poems. I had actually read one or two of them on the radio, on BBC Schools radio. So suddenly, if you produce a book for children, it doesn't even have to be a very good book, but the world of children's books is very welcoming. Immediately you start getting invited and taken places, and you're sitting in front of, in libraries and schools. And I was invited into a school called Princess Frederica in Kensal Rise. And the deputy head there was a wonderful Irish bloke called Sean McElhain, and he said, I really want you to come because we love these poems. They're so lively, da-da-da-da. So I arrived at the school, and I don't know whether any of you have tried talking to 400 London children, but it has its challenges. And I thought I was going to read to about five kids, you see, and he said, boys and girls, he pulled me into the hall, there were 400 kids in front of me, and he said, boys and girls, this is the moment we've been waiting for. Michael Rosen, who wrote that book, Mind Your Own Business. And they went, yeah, like that. And I kind of flattened myself against the back wall, you know, kind of looking at them all, and he said, Michael, over to you. And I kind of picked up my book, and I'd only ever read them on the radio, you see, so I thought, well, I'll kind of do it like you do on the radio. So I kind of picked up the book and put it in front of my face so they couldn't see me. And I went, the ship in the docks at the end of the trip. The man on board's the captain of the ship. The name of the man is Old Ben Brown. He played the ukulele with his trousers down. Now, London kids will give you about 10 seconds, if you're lucky, before they immediately turn towards each other, start pulling the Velcro off each other's ship, and then fiddling with each other's hair, taking glasses off and all the rest of it. And they were just beginning as I got to the end of the poem, and I glanced across at Sean, and his face, I can remember it now, it was like a look of sadness and disappointment and just sort of turning into loathing, you know what I mean? And he went, no, it doesn't go like that, does it, boys and girls? And I went, what? And he said, we know how it goes, don't we? And then he went, he literally danced, I promise you, he danced across the front of the hall going, the ship in the docks at the end of the trip, and the man on board's the captain of the ship. The name of the man was Old Ben Brown, and he played the ukulele with his... And the whole lot went, trousers down, trousers down. And they carried on for about 5 minutes doing little kind of rhythmic vibes and stuff on it, you know, and I'm standing there going... Anyways, it was one of those moments, I believe... Christians call it epiphany, it was that sort of moment, and then I realised you've got to take this, and I was like reconnected with what I'd been doing all through my childhood, which was, you know, doing theatre and all the rest of it. So I suddenly thought, connection, poem, theatre, performance, so that's 1974, and virtually ever since then I've gone to schools two or three times a week and I do poetry shows. Well, bit by bit, even I can manage to learn some of the poems. It's a bit of a struggle for me, but I do. And then they become even more extempore, if you like. And then I, because I start changing them, and then I make up new stuff. And then I think, oh, I could write down that thing that I was talking about. So quite randomly, I started talking about hairy blankets the other day, about how you could have a blanket that was so hairy that even if you looked at it, you would end up with hair in your mouth. You see, and the kids were all going, like that, and I was going, yeah, but there are some blankets that are that hairy, and then I suddenly remembered that the hairy blanket of all hairy blankets was the one that they used to make us sleep under when I was at nursery school, and how I refused. I used to go on strike, okay? It was part of the red diaper thing, obviously. That I refused to sleep, you see, because of the hairy blanket. So what started off as a sort of kind of little riff on hairy blankets, you see, then turned into something I wrote, which can then be something I can then perform. So it's like a sort of little circle. So that eventually does answer your question. Sorry it took a bit of time, but anyway. Yeah.
Any more questions? At the back there.
Hello.
Hi.
Do you feel that there are the same sort of core of children's authors now, or is poetry underrepresented in children now?
This last Labour government, in all its wisdom, invented something called the National Literacy Strategy, which meant that literature stopped existing. It became literacy. And if you call it literacy, that means you can chop it up into little bits, create a matrix, and tell teachers when to teach it. So what happened to poetry was that it started happening in year one, term two, week four, but then in week five you didn't have to do it, and then that would be repeated. So in fact, and I've watched my own kids do this, is that what they did was actually not start reading poetry, but stop reading poetry. That was the main thing that they learned. And though they didn't prescribe authors, they recommended some. So when you did haiku, they recommended haiku authors. And when you did ballads, they recommended you do ballads, you see. And it all fitted in with this system. And then the bloke who devised it all, who shall be nameless, see me afterwards, he then got a really brilliant idea, even more brilliant than the ones that I've so far expounded. This was to produce an anthology called All the Poems You Need for the Literacy Hour. I mean, think about it, the idea of a book called All the Poems You Need. It's quite offensive, really, isn't it? Because the whole point about poetry is there are never all the poems you need, isn't it, really? But never mind. Anyway, so he produced that, and that pretty well closed things down. So this was one of the major achievements of the National Literacy Strategy, was that it sort of created this matrix, created an anthology that made this bloke a swift buck or two, and that's the way it was. So if you open that All the Poems You Need for the Literacy Hour, is the answer to your question. I think I'm in there, but you know, it's not a bad range. It's quite a good anthology. I wouldn't slag the anthology off. It's the whole method in it of what it is. So I've tried to counter that by saying and doing workshops with teachers where what I say is, how can you set up a poetry-friendly classroom? Worry less about teaching poetry and more just about how can it be that poems in your classroom are things that people want to read. Then you've cracked it. Shouldn't worry about teaching the stuff, because it's pretty resistant to teaching. It's mostly, if you teach it, you end up humiliating people. In fact, most people's memory of poetry is a kind of form of mild humiliation. And so there's always somebody who's supposed to know more about it than you, which is disastrous, really. And I always say to teachers, for Christ's sake, don't ask any questions of a poem that you know the answer to. So if it's a question that you do know the answer to, like how many full stops are there in this poem, it must be a crap question. So start again and think, if there's a question you really don't know the answer to in relation to this poem, like does this poem remind you of anything, or is there any question you would like to ask of anybody in the poem, then probably you're onto a winner. But the moment you know, so that's my thinking around poetry in schools. Yeah, it's very nice, people do know my stuff, and they know Rogers and so on, and I hope, and they do get to know a lot of other poets as well if you set up a much more freewheeling thing than the NLS, as it's called, prescribed.
Yeah. Any more questions? Dorothy.
John and a couple of other people here know that I've been trying to write a children's book.
Hooray.
Somebody writing a really good children's book. I mean, sorts of things make the difference and make it a good
Some way or another, you have to put the child inside your head. Now, whether that child is you, as you were, or whether it's a child that you know, like a nephew, a niece, a son, or daughter, or whatever, or whether it's some children you come across in a school or a play group or wherever, it doesn't matter, and it can be a combination of any of those, but some part of the writer for children has got to do that. The only other way, and we can, because we're very flexible as human beings, is to fill your mind and brain with texts that have appealed to children, so you kind of get it secondhand. And as writers, people can do that. I mean, you know, many of the people who've written brilliant American movies aren't necessarily people who've got children. What they've done is learn the craft of making movie scripts and what previous kids' movies have done. Yeah? So there's several routes to do it. Now, what you end up with, I wouldn't dare prescribe, because it is very, very diverse, the world of children's books. I mean, you can point to various aspects, but it's kind of, you start getting banal if you say what they are. I mean, 99.9% of children's books resolve in a certain kind of a way, a certain redeeming, homecoming sort of a way. Things get resolved in a way. And of course, adults who read children's books quite often find that slightly unsatisfactory or slightly too cosy, because it somehow implies that the world can be righted within the covers of between the two covers of a book, or that somehow every children's book implies that the world is fallen, you know, it's sort of post-fall, and that somehow or other the book can be prelapsarian, somewhere or another the book can get to Eden. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of that going on, but I mean, in terms of what its elements are, I would never dare say to you, you know, you've got to find, it might be about something terribly sad, it might be about something terribly funny, you know, the moment people put their foot down and say what a children's book is, you'll find exceptions to it, and the exception of all exceptions is nearly always Roald Dahl anyway. You know, he got away with doing stuff that editors said, you can't do that! And he went, oh yes, I will. And there was bugger all they could do about it by then, because he was selling so many millions. So, you know, even this redemption thing, if you remember the end of The Witches, the boy stays a mouse. Well, that's, that break, oh God, have I just ruined the book for you? that breaks all the rules, do you see what I mean? So, you know, and people have said for years what a picture book can and can't do, and then along comes somebody like Oliver Jeffers or something, and he just completely breaks all the rules. You know, people say it's got to have a strong narrative. You get Emily Gravett, there's no narrative. Do you see? So you have to be very, very cautious. Probably the best thing to do is just to read books that you think are kind of near or near enough to what you're trying to do, and enjoy them, and then do something slightly different. Put yourself outside and kind of monitor what the book has done and how it's done it. What structures, what tricks has it used? The writer Morris Gleitzman once said that his trick of writing for children, he said, is that I start every scene as late as I can. And I said, what does that mean? And he said, well, instead of setting everything up, I've eliminated anything that sounds or feels like an intro. I just start in the middle of every scene. So when I cut from one scene to another, it's very dynamic. You're just instantly into another scene. And if you look at, actually, a lot of great writers, they do that. I mean, Romeo and Juliet does, actually, which was one of the paciest, fastest moving pieces of fiction that has ever been written. And you'll find that the scenes keep starting in the middle. Well, that's a great rule of thumb. On the other hand, you get someone like, I don't know, Siobhan O'Dowd, and she's very contemplative, or Helen Dunmore. So you get, I would hesitate to make rules. I'm afraid all I can suggest is read and read and then do some more reading, really. Is that any use to you? It can be you. It can be who you were. You know, it can be who you, if it's aimed at a 10-year-old, think what you...
I think I have been doing that, but now I'm
Yeah. And do read it to them, and get children to read it. I mean, then that leaves the problem as to whether they'll tell you the truth or whether they know what the truth. I mean, my daughter is just reading her way through the Lemony Snicket books and the Spiderwick Chronicle books, and I say to her, "Do you like them?" She goes, "Eh." That's about it. She's a very articulate child, but that's all she wants to talk to me about. So all I've got is, "Eh." So there we are. They work, those books, because, "Eh." I mean, I'm sure she's thinking a lot, but I haven't got to it yet, and maybe she'll never tell me. Why should she? Bloody dad, anyway. What's it? Mind your own business. Do you see what I mean? So you could do with maybe a child confidant who could tell you about what books he or she likes. That would help. The best thing of all is to get two children talking to each other and you get a bug on them and listen in. That's the best thing of all.
Right, so you heard it here first, bug children. For guaranteed writing success. I think we've got time for just one more question at the back.
I suspect that you, like me, have managed to grow old without growing up. Does that help?
Yeah, but the impediment to that is having children. Because every now and then you have to, like, be responsible and take control and all sorts of things like that. So there's quite a little battle that goes on inside me between the kind of 11-year-old nerd, the 15-year-old yobbo, and the 64-year-old parent. So it's quite a struggle that goes on between these various personae. So I believe it or not, I have a 5-year-old and a 34-year-old, so it's quite a range. I often describe myself as the longest running school parent that I've ever met. I've been to more parents' evenings as a parent than I think anybody I've ever met. So I am learning to be a parent. I can actually now get my 5-year-old to go upstairs around about 9:30 at bed. You know, when I go home, he'll still be up. And I now go, and he ignores me. So, yeah, whereas my dad used to go, actually it did work for a bit, and then me and my brother started doing it to each other, and so when he did it after about some period of time, I don't know when, we'd just be so pissing ourselves at laughing, but anyway, he hasn't learned that yet, but anyway, he will now. So anyway, a bit of a struggle going on there, I think you'll find, yeah.
Fantastic. Thanks for that, and thanks for answering all our questions.
Pleasure.
We do have a limited number of Michael's selected poems on sale here, which he's kindly sent your autograph, but there are 6 here, so you'll have to fight each other to get to the front. They're on sale. We're having a break now. There is drink and food at the bar. Anna's going to come round and menace you for £3.50 in the peppermint tin, and we'll have a quick break and
I'll do a little plug for my website. I have a website where there's lots of performances of my poems on there that my son, the 34-year-old, not the 5-year-old, filmed me doing, and I'm going to be putting up a lot more fairly soon. So you can just Google my name and it'll come up, and then if you've got children that you've hired or kidnapped or whatever, you can show them to them. So anyway, there you go. Thanks very much.
Thank you.